This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And today's guest is Bronwyn Williams, futurist, economist, and business trends analyst. And we're going to put her to work to take those specialities and apply them to the political world as it can be seen through the eyes of new generations moving forward into adulthood. Generation Y and Z and X and Q and W and whoever else is around at this point. Part of the challenge is, of course, that everything in this country now starts to be looked at through the lens of an upcoming election. And this program will follow suit. We will do a lot of talk about elections. We've interviewed a fair number of people from various political parties, but we wanted to step back just slightly and let someone who looks at big trends, big pictures, and help us understand what it all means. And Bronwyn is one of the partners at Flux Trends. And I have always wanted to ask your partner, Dion Chang, does it ever get confused with flux capacitor?
Not so much, although there is quite a lot of trends in the flux industry. If you want to start getting into the nitty-gritty of the middle industry, sometimes I think that's where you get the most confusion from at the international level.
Yeah, well, I mean, flux capacitor, of course, is the imaginary equipment that ran the car that
DeLorean, Back to the Future.
The DeLorean Gullwing, yeah, Back to the Future and Back to the Past and then Back to the Future again. It was always the flux capacitor, although none of us have ever seen one that actually works. But the name itself just got my attention. Futurology is one of those topics. Of course, it's a whole lot easier to predict the past than it is the future. But when someone calls themselves a futurologist, they are trying to find some way, finding hinge points or continuity or break points in the trends that they see. And then the question, obviously, is what are the things that you look for? What are the red flags or the signposts or the hidden indicators, that little tiny thing that becomes the butterfly effect that changes everything? And before I let her answer that, though, let me just add that she's also the co-author of The Future Starts Now. She's been a columnist for various business and technology publications, and she has provided commentaries on networks like CNBC Africa and ENCA in South Africa. And she's got a whole string of degrees from South Africa and British universities, including University of Johannesburg, University of London, University of Manchester, Stellenbosch, and the University of Bath. Brandon Bronwyn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me here today.
Now tell me, what are the trends that you look for? What are those hidden cues, those special ideas that allow you to say, aha, that's what's going on and that's why we need to pay attention?
Well, I think, first of all, trends are actually quite boring almost because they're all backwards looking, aren't they? Trends are just something, just the continuation of business as usual. Whether you are looking at them from a quantitative or from a qualitative perspective, I think we tend to look at trends more. People talk to people like myself, they're generally talking about more qualitative ones, the more interesting sort of signals. But quantitative trend analysis is something that we are used to every day and we apply it in our day-to-day lives. So this is like when your central bankers get on the news and tell you about what interest rates are coming, or when political analysts get on platforms like this and tell you what election results are coming. They're generally basing those inferences based on post-past data, either that is based on what people have voted for in the past or how they've polled, if you want to talk about politics, or we're looking about past economic indicators, what were jobs like, what was unemployment like in the past. Or we even try to predict the weather. We do the same sort of thing. That's the trend. We look at the trend line. We look at the past. We look at what was the weather like last year, last century, last decade. And we try and plot it forwards because for the most part, that's pretty much all we've got to go on. If we're trying to predict what comes next, there's no better indicator of tomorrow than yesterday until it's not, because then often we have breaks in those trend lines. And that's where things get interesting, where people get surprised or taken at a disadvantage because they weren't ready for a change that was coming. And that's why people tend to look to people like myself, is not so much to predict along trend lines, because anyone can go plot some data into a chart and see, we'll see what happens if it continues on the way it was in the past. But it takes a different sort of skill set and different sort of way of looking at the world to see what happens if that trend line does not continue, if things that were going up start to come down, or when that's going to happen, or why that's likely to happen, or if things that were going left, why do they now start blowing right, to use a very literal metaphor when it comes to the sort of whole sort of political sense. And that's why we look for things that we call signals. And signals are sort of anything that feels weird or strange on the horizon. The best way I can sort of describe that is saying that our role in the futures space, or in the sort of extending beyond trend analysis space into the world of futures, almost like the contemporary equivalent of a medieval watchman who would stand on the keep on those towers, little circular towers at the edges of the castle, and sort of scan around the horizon, looking for any signs of trouble, any marauding hordes or blowing winds that could disrupt business or life as usual behind the castle keep. So that's what we're looking at there. And I think that when it comes to looking at those sorts of breaks, we can look at it at a macro picture or from a more micro picture. And we can talk through some of those things today, particularly when we are looking at the future of politics and the future of politics in quite a chaotic space like South Africa right now. In terms of the macro sort of trend patterns and trend breaks that we can be looking for, one of the classic tools that we had used is that of generational cohort studies, which I always love to talk about, because it's very unpopular in the futures and trend analysis space at the moment. People say, of course, generational cohorts are just cliches, but we say, not so fast. Actually, generational cohorts make a lot of sense because these are groups of people who have grown up at a particular time in human history and that have graduated in a particular world that is different to other generations. And in particular, when we want to sort of put dividing lines between generational cohorts to understand why they behave, why the kids today behave the way they do, why they don't behave the way kids yesterday used to behave, we want to really be looking at, and I think this is really important for the whole sort of future of politics conversation, we want to be looking at the happiness equation. That is the difference between expectations and reality. And this, for me, is a very neat dividing line for most of the generational cohorts that people like myself talk about too much. You know, the difference between Generation X, the latchkey 80s generation, or the millennials, the sad sacks who wear hemp clothes and eat avocado toast, or the new Generation Zs who are disrupting things in the workplace, or the born frees, as we call them in South Africa right now. The key differences between those cohorts, and you can go further back in time too, is that difference between expectation and reality. And here, I think it's quite useful to just distinguish between the two generations that we have far too much about, millennials, a people kind of like myself in early middle age right now. There'd be people that were born in the early 1980s up until sort of mid-1990s. And for that generational cohort, there's a deficit in the expectations versus reality equation. We were a generation that was brought up with large expectations in the 80s of big shoulder pads and fur and perms. And everything was bigger and better by parents who told us that we were wonderful and fantastic and we'd all get our participation trophies, which we are mocked for relentlessly in different contexts. And yet we graduated into the middle of the 2008 financial crisis, into huge financial uncertainty. And as we were starting to finally get our careers in place, of course, then you had the different waves of wars and rumors of wars and COVIDs and those sorts of things. This is a generation that never quite seemed to realize its full potential. So it's a generation of disappointment.
Let me stop you here just for a sec to say that you and I are actually from different generations or cohorts. I'm sort of in the early middle part of the baby boom generation. Mm-hmm. It was particularly pronounced in countries like Britain, the United States, and Western Europe, in which suddenly there was an enormous collection of children, babies, then children, and then teenagers, all of whom had wants and needs and desires and industries that were desperate to provide that entertainment. Mm. And culture changed accordingly. I mean, the birth of popular music that became rock and roll and so forth, they were not imaginary. Those were real things that happened. And
absolutely. I mean, That generation set the whole tone, right? I mean, like the baby boomer generation, where quite often people refer to that. You refer to when they were born, post-World War, this massive cohort that was born again into a whole season of optimism, right? So if you're sort of following the generational curves, you know, very much born into a season of optimism. But this is also, you're the generation who, when you hit teenagehood, were the ones at the forefront of the free love revolutions too, right? I mean, this is the generation that like pulled back against expansion and started first challenging these ideas of things like capitalism and globalization. But also, this is the generation that might be known as the boomers that live in houses today and like aren't passing on generational wealth because God forbid you living longer. You know, this is the sort of core of generational conflict at the moment. But at the same time, you were the generation that challenged the norms of the family, the nuclear family dynamic. I think that's also important to the conversation we're going to have today, because politics at a national level, it can't be too far separated from politics at a nuclear, but family level either. So yes, I think it's right to sort of put that in perspective. But just to come back to what I was saying about those whole sort of expectations and reality, I think the boomer generation was probably characterized by a generation where expectations and reality kind of met up, right? Like the sort of expectations about the world's economic growth patterns and the political general trajectory towards sort of more is more was kind of, though those expectations didn't have such a huge deficit in them. It's changed now. And we can see this particularly as what we call it to be the weird West, the Western educated, rich, industrialized world, where millennials were the children of the boomers who had these higher expectations, but the world has not delivered. I mean, like we still see 40-year-old millennials that haven't bought properties yet, still haven't found themselves or found a career, that are still in the sort of protracted adolescence, is one of the side effects of that expectation versus reality gap. And of course, we don't need to point blame at parents or people. We're grown-ups by now. We can deal with our own stuff. But in terms of political mindset, I think it's really interesting to look at how millennials are the first Western generation in that weird West over the last century and a bit. So if you want to go back all the way to 1900 until right now, who, as we have aged, we have not become more right-wing in our thinking. Because generally, if you look at the past, what happened was when people are younger and idealistic and have lots of friends and all those different things, young people tend to be more sort of left-wing in their politics. But as they get older, they tend to pivot more to the right, because once you've got some wealth to protect, suddenly, of course, your values shift, right? And this is the sort of natural trend. And that has been the case for almost every generation in living memory. However, with millennials.
We have to stop here. We have to take a station break. There are those rules and we have to do it. We're going to come back to the point you're talking about. But this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And my guest today, this morning, is Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends. And we're talking about generational cohorts and the impact on society. We'll be right back in a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Bronwyn Williams from Flux Trends. That's the outfit that also houses Dion Chang, who listeners to this program will have heard, I guess, almost a year ago when we were talking about similar kinds of things, but there wasn't an election in hand. And just before we took our break, you were saying that the generation that is the children of the baby boomers is a generation of people who largely have not drifted rightward in their political and social feelings. Is that because they remain infantile, or is that just culture itself has changed?
Well, culture is part of it, but also the wealth transfer is also part of it. We touched on this a bit earlier too, that their parents, the baby boomers, are living longer. And this is generally a good thing, right? One of the signs of human flourishing. Progress is longer lifespans, but longer lifespans means intergenerational wealth transfers happen at a later date. If your parents stick around for longer, you don't get to benefit from your inheritance. That's a very blunt way to put it. But at a global scale, we see a lot of op-eds about this sort of intergenerational wealth transfer there. That's part of it. But it's also a case of the general political environment too, and the general economic climates, particularly again in the West. And we are talking today from a Western perspective. These things aren't quite the same in different parts of the world with different birth rates and different economic trajectories. But overall, the West is kind of tied together by the dollar. And that, you know, as you know, rising tides sort of lift all boats. And at the same time, when things get choppy, because we're so globalized and connected, things kind of get choppy altogether. But anyway, the facts are, and there's a wonderful article in the Financial Times they put out, I think about Q3 last year, that looked at this, and you can see the trend break quite clearly there. And trend breaks are where interesting things happen. That's where the future changes. With previous generations, when like boomers were young, when they were in their 20s, they skewed left in their politics, that normal Western trajectory. But as boomers got older, they moved more right. And we can see this in results of big global elections, not to use South African examples, but the likes of Brexit and the right likes of Trump. As the population got older, the results of elections kind of got a bit more skewed rightwards over time. I won't get into the definitions there, but the point is with millennials, as we've got older, we've moved more left, not more right at all. Which is why, again, I think generational cohort studies are interesting, because these sorts of data points show that actually, no, not all young people are the same, but the time and place that you're born does make a difference. The peers that you are surrounded with do make a difference on aggregate. And of course, there are exceptions, but that's the wonderful thing about stereotypes. They're good at telling big stories, but of course, there are exceptions within all those rules, just to sort of deal with that point, because there's always someone that wants to argue with that. However, I suppose the most important point, yeah.
Let me just interrupt and say you're talking about the leftward versus rightward trend, and you point to Brexit and the rise of Donald Trump and presumably Viktor Orban and maybe even potentially Vladimir Putin and people of that ilk. But what I have noticed is that in some Western European countries, and I think Germany is a particularly good example of this, younger people have moved to the right.
And yes, we'll get to that now.
To the previous generation's leftward tilt. So that AFG or whatever, alles für German, for AFD, alles für Deutschland, is archetypally right-wing party, and it's mostly young people.
Yeah, and this is the difference, again, looking at generational cohorts between the millennial generation, who, as I said, are no longer children. We're now in early middle age. The oldest millennials are well over 40 and have children of their own. Some of them are even grandparents, because you can do that if you sort of do the maths there. But the difference between the millennial generation and Generation Z, or in South Africa, we have another very nice watershed to break this generation, Generation Z, off. We can also call them here the born free generation. They are the generation who were born after the fall of apartheid, not before it. So in South Africa, we've got a very clean break between those two generations. But this also plays out at global scale. Generation Z has the opposite in terms of their happiness versus expectations reality equation. They had low expectations and have actually had a world that has delivered more than perhaps they expected to get. Now, I am saying that with quite a big proviso. This generation didn't expect much from us. We've done a lot of research with this group, particularly in South Africa, and their absolute disdain for anyone older than them, from millennials all the way up through X and boomers, is quite significant. They are a generation that's grown up with climate anxiety. They've grown up, they were born, they were children when 2008 took place, when the Twin Towers fell. They've grown up in a world of uncertainty and perma-crisis, and as such, they don't expect things to be easy, whereas my generation was pretty much told things would be easy. We are very special. We were very wonderful, you know, complete snowflakes, each of us, and we can be anything we want to be. This generation doesn't believe that. They rather believe more that either they're quite nihilistic, like they believe that they're doomed, humanity's doomed, so you might as well live in the moment, or they believe that nobody else is going to fix the place, so they're going to be the generation that's going to come with the broom and clean it up themselves. So they've got this quite interesting split between apathy and anarchy and activism between this group. And that happiness versus reality expectations curve, I think, is a great predictor. In other words, the world you were born into compared to the world you graduated into is quite a good predictor as to where on the traditional Nolan chart political spectrum between left and right, between more zero-sum type thinking or adversarial type thinking and more sort of collectivist type thinking comes from. And with Generation Z, who are really just starting to get onto the voter's roll, if they registered at all, which is a different point, is we are starting to see, a swing back to the right. There's a lot of parallels, and I love the way history doesn't repeat itself, but it's got a great rhythm section. There's a great parallel between the Generation Z's attitude to the world and Generation X's excessive attitude to the world. Generation X was the generation who were teenagers in the 1980s, and they are the parents of Generation Z. Generally, if you want to see how children behave in comparison to their parents, they either turn out quite a lot like them or the complete opposite, right? But with Generation Z, in terms of their politics, we are seeing younger people dabbling in more right-wing politics, which millennials have pulled away from, as I've said, quite dramatically, and there's quite good data to point at that. But what's interesting with Generation X is there is a gender divide. And again, remember, I started this conversation before the break talking about how gender politics and nuclear family politics relates to the bigger scale too. And what we've seen with Generation X now is there's pretty interesting data coming out showing that young females in Generation X are still tending quite left, but young men are skewing quite right quite fast. And this could be because in the general consensus and discourse around society, around people's place in society at the moment, there's been a lot of, this is a generation who's grown up hearing that feminism is good and that men are the problem in the world, right? And of course, you get reaction. With every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's also a generation who's grown up with gender and identity politics too. It's a generation that is basically being taught through the implementation of policies with very good intentions, policies like affirmative action, policies like gender hiring quotas on boards, that have essentially been told that your immutable characteristics define your place in life. And for this reason, people that find themselves on the more or less privileged scorecards that we've now codified into our legal systems through race and gender-based policy are now transferring into behavior. When we've instilled these values, and we really have instilled the values that we need scorecards in order to make the world a fair place because meritocracy doesn't work. So these messages have sunk in. And this generation is proving to be ethno-nationalist in their politics. You mentioned some of the right-wing swings in Europe. That's part of that. So is nationalist policy here in South Africa. Young people in South Africa are quite happy to support very ethno-nationalist policy. Here, of course, we have a horrible history of both racism between black, white in South Africa, but we've also got a horrible history of xenophobia. And these are, unfortunately, the sort of darker sides of Generation Z politics. They are highly politicized around immutable characteristics. And this is where we can start to see more extremist and more populist leaders getting into power. Now, I'm not dismissing this whole generation at all. I think it's quite interesting when you talk about Generation Z, separate these aspects of apathy, activism, and sort of anarchy. And you will find different faces of that.
We're going to break here for another station identification. Hold that thought because I want you to continue on that vein. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today, a particularly provocative and interesting conversation with Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends, not to be confused with Flux Capacitors. I had to get that in. And we'll be right back after this.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Bronwyn Williams from Flux Trends. And we were just about to dive into the effect of the split in gender terms and age cohorts on South Africa's politics. And I interrupted her, and I hope she's going to pick up exactly at that point, because it is really important and really interesting. Please.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty fine line we're sort of skating here, but I do think it's important to have these conversations that address the realities around us head on. So what I'm saying, in terms of South African politics, Generation Z can either find itself falling into anarchy and nihilism, or towards more activism, or towards anarchy. We kind of see these three different cohorts of this class that has graduated into very low expectations for the future given to it by previous generations. And as such, when it comes to politics and their politics, we do, on the more dangerous side, the more anarchy side, we do see young people, and particularly, as I said, young men being attracted to quite right-wing. And of course, right-wing in a South African context is a bit different to right-wing in an international context.
The
right-wing identity would be quite an ethno-nationalistic identity, because that's a pretty classic observation of what right-wing kind of politics is. But of course, understanding right-wing social politics could be quite different to right-wing economic politics. I don't think we have much right-wing economic politics at all in South Africa. So in order to make this conversation useful and interesting, let's first focus on the social aspects of the right-wing, left-wing, but it's dynamic. And of course, it's a very binary way to look at the world, and we shouldn't fall into those traps. But we only have a few minutes to talk about this, so let's talk about it in terms of it. So let's get out that out the way. Pretty much all of our economic politics is quite left wing over here. But in terms of where people fall, we do see young people attracted to quite populist ideas, or at least to the idea of populist ideas. And this, of course, brings me to one of the things that I've written quite a lot about with Generation Z and politics in South Africa. And that's the fact that we actually don't have any populist politicians to harness the populist hole in the young South African's political soul. And I find this quite interesting, right? I know that the EFF has tried to fill that space, but young voter registration over the last two voting cycles, when Generation Z first was able to vote, proved that, quite frankly, that brand of populism has not been enough to get the apathetic non-registered young South African voter to go and vote. So we've kind of got this dangerous dynamic where we do have young people that would like to skew right and populist, or left and populist, as the case may be, but there don't seem to be any strong populist leaders promising this generation anything to sort of move them beyond apathy towards activism and action, politically speaking or otherwise. And this is quite ironic, given the number of, or the sheer number of parties and people that are going to be on our ballots this year. Still, none of that menu is dynamic, exciting enough. And exciting here could be dangerously exciting or constructively exciting. But what they lack is any sort of promise that will give this generation a better tomorrow. None of them are offering to raise expectations for the future, or the actual lived lives of the young people in our country. So this is a kind of political vacuum that we have for young people that explains the apathy. And we do have particularly low voter registrations. And this is a trend across the world. Young people aren't registering as much as they used to. And when they do register, they vote quite extreme, quite populist.
Let me interrupt for a second, because I'm not sure I understand. From what I can gather of politicians who would tap into that populist vein, you cite the EFF in particular, there is a quality of redistributive economics embedded in their message. It isn't a series of specific proposals for the most part. What there also, though, is in it is a serious vein of ethnic political argument.
Yes.
Does that square with what you found?
Well, yes, I would say young people are interested in economic justice. Absolutely. I would say that the arguments or the manifestos put forward by our political parties, even the more populist ones, are not promising them what they want. I think that it would be dismissive to insult the intelligence of the young people in South Africa by assuming that they actually believe that there's much to redistribute. So a policy that's based on redistribution of a shrinking economy is not enough to actually inflame a young person to go and vote, a young person who's probably quite self-interested and has quite a zero-sum view of the world. This is another thing that has been established, that younger people have more adversarial ways of seeing the world, that they understand if I win, you lose, if you win, I lose. So that's kind of a lot of the sort of framing around economics is framed around scarcity. But scarcity, or promises based on scarcity and redistribution, are not necessarily enough, even to get someone who does identify with left-leaning economic policies to the polls, unless they also promise something else. Which kind of brings up the other point that you're making there. And like, economics is one sort of angle. If you look at politics, more redistributive, more capitalist, whatever you want to look at there. The point is, as long as people don't believe that they're going to get more cake at the end of the day, they're not actually interested in your debates about what size their relative share is going to be if they know it's not going to be enough to actually sustain them. I think that we should give young people credit in that regard. The other part is, of course, the ethnic nationalism, which is unfortunately a darker side of Generation Z globally. Very nationalist and very ethno-nationalist politics is on the rise. And that, for me, would definitely be seen as quite a right-wing social policy, even if we are sort of pushing for more economic left-wing policy. That is a trend, and it's a worrying trend, because it's a trend that's taking place at the same time that our global economies are so globalized and so connected and so networked and so intrinsically linked that we can't actually separate it. At the same time, our economies are becoming more linked and more codependent. We do see nations doubling down on ethnic-based policies, and we do see the rise of that sort of political party coming to the fore. Whether you're looking at Europe or you're looking at Africa, this is something that I kind of see going on all around the world. And I think it's quite dangerous, particularly when you start layering on the actual hot wars that are going on around the world at the moment, which are also quite a lot to do not with nation-based nationality, but also to do with like ethno-nationality again. I think that this is a trend that's worth keeping an eye on from a less positive perspective. But I don't want to stay on the negative side of things altogether. I think that the other point that I want to make very clearly about this Generation Z, as I said, you want to kind of separate them into kind of three very large sort of camps: the apathetic, the ones who won't vote, who have given up on the future, who might have climate anxiety and be seeing a therapist because they're worried about not having a planet in the future, or they're worried about the AI singularity, not having a job. This generation that feels that they can't move, they're stuck and they don't have any agency. There's also the part that dabbles with anarchy, that dabbles with populism, that dabbles with ethno-nationalism, these very, very dangerous, dangerous ideas, very destabilizing to society. There's also a part of this cohort that are natural activists. And I've left that for last, although I think it's probably the most important part of this generation. In fact, it's definitively what has defined them in our work in analyzing this generation. And that is, this is a generation who's got involved in the proper or the ordered channels of politics and economics from a very young age. This is a generation that's been listed on ballots. I mean, we've had something like 18-year-old senators in the US, which is just incredible. We've had young people leading climate justice campaigns. Whether you like them or not, that's irrelevant to my point. My point is that these are young people who have garnered global attention and influenced policy at an international, never mind a national level, while they're still teenagers, while they're still in school. So generation is prepared to challenge authority and is prepared to work within the realms and the channels of society as we know it, the constitution, the policies, the parties that we have, or around it, if there are no spaces for them within those systems that will allow them in. And I think this is the opportunity, and what I'm getting to when I say that young people have no one that resonates with them on the ballot. My thesis is that this generation is going to breed their own cohorts of new politicians that might not necessarily live on the ballot, but might challenge it from without the system, from without or from within, in quite positive ways. That doesn't have to be a negative story here at all. I think it's a challenge to authority systems that simply aren't working, to aging politicians, to geriatric men all across the world and across the African continent too, making decisions
that we never live to. We're going to take a station break, and I want to explore that at some length, because this is the gerontocracy rules issue is really relevant, I think, now in the United States, and certainly in parts of Europe, and presumably in this country as well. You have politicians here in their 80s attempting yet one more bite at the apple. So let's take this quick break. We're talking with Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as usual. And today's guest, Bronwyn Williams. And we're trying to set, Bronwyn is from Flux Change, and we're trying to set flux trends, excuse me, flux trends.
Good name.
And I've gotten that scrambled with flux capacitor already twice, so let's move beyond that problem. But she was setting out the question, just as we stopped for a station break, of the geriatric generation still holding on to power and the pushback from the 25-year-olds or the 28-year-olds saying, wait a minute, our time is here now. And if you look in the U.S., the logic of the complaint by many voters, regardless of their political persuasion, is, wait a minute, we're going to have two octogenarians vying for the presidency, in effect. In this country, most of the people who say they want to be in charge, not all, but most of them appear to be almost as old. In many other places, you get the same response. And if you look to China, the people in charge of China, they don't seem to want to get older. They already are, and they refuse to give way. Xi Jinping, after all, has engineered it so he can rule until he's dead. And Vladimir Putin in Russia is no spring chicken either. And then, of course, as you go around this continent, there are a lot of people who are at the top of the heap politically in many countries who are also equally old, not doddering, but they're certainly not young. And yet there is this educated, thoughtful generation which knows there are problems, and they are elbowing people, or they're desperate to elbow this old mob out of the way. How is this going to work?
Well, firstly, I think they're going to succeed, and certainly in the South African context. I think it's also worth putting a note out there that for the global context, globally, as a planet, there are more people over the age of 35 than under 35 on our planet. Basically, we have a declining or an aging population at global level, and that if you're a country that doesn't have a declining population or an aging population, you are one of the minorities. South Africa, even, we tend to think we're part of Africa and we've got this high population growth rate. Well, not really. We have a high population growth rate compared to Europe, but we're not much above population growth rate if you're looking at South African passport holders. Almost all of our population growth is coming from immigration, and mainly from immigration within the continent, from the actually high-growing parts of the world. So demography really is destiny, but that is a bit further down the line. Demographic trends are very, very, very hard to shift. China's tried to shift it. It tried to reduce birth rates. There's quite good evidence that even with its draconian policies of forced abortions and, post-birth abortions too, in order to try and control the population, there's quite good evidence to show that the government's interference in population wasn't very successful on the decline. The decline happened despite, not because of government interference. And now their interference in trying to increase the population is failing just as dismally. Even when you're wanting to give people incentives like cars and houses and straight up money to have babies, it's very difficult to change that. These are very slow trends to change. And they only change when people's expectations, again, about the future shifts. And the expectations are very closely, of course, related to their values and our value systems, whether we value careers or families more, as women, as families, as men, as everyone sort of put together. But that's kind of almost a side point. We want to look at what's happening in South Africa with the disconnect between voters and geriatric people in power. We're, again, a bit of an exception, even at a continental level. Again, there's much wider differences between the age of people in power and the ages of the electorate across the continent than there is with us. We do at least have some people on the ballot who are not past retirement age, at least they would be in the private sector, right? I mean, other parts of the world, there's no one, as you said, that's actually below retirement age that's being standing for office. But again, if I come back to generational cohorts, I think it's also worth noting, this is something we know from the corporate sector as well as from the political sector, there is a leadership gap when it comes to generations. We see older people in management positions that we don't see a field and or an appetite for the missing middle, which is now my millennial generation, to actually step up into that leadership role. And that sort of concave, almost sort of management ladder or career ladder, whether you're looking again public or private sector, is something we're going to see leapfrogging on, I believe, quite soon from Generation Z, this younger generation who is now going into the workplace. They're much hungry. They're much less patient than the millennial cohort was. Again, I come back to that. Why? Well, that expectation reality deficit / surplus curve makes quite a big difference in your agency and how you take and claim leadership titles. It's worth noting leadership, just like any sort of conquering, is taken. It's not asked for. It's not something that you get handed. It's something that you have to grab. And that's perhaps why we do see this sort of age gap or this age sort of cavern in the sort of the leadership curves and the career projections or progressions through the various tiers of management and power. And that's why we are seeing and why we're so excited now to sort of start tracking young people grabbing power, or to stepping up and to putting themselves into spaces that they're never going to get invited into. That's the thing with power. That's the thing with holding positions of power and privilege. You get removed from them, often quite violently, whether that's figuratively or literally speaking. It's not something that you hand on. People stay and hang on for as long as they can until they are effectively pushed out. And you can't be pushed out unless you're offering a viable alternative. And that's, of course, a lesson South African politics should learn from American politics. But American elections over the last few years have been won by losers rather than won by winners, right? So essentially, if your opponent lost harder than you did, you won. But no one was voting for anyone, really. People were voting against the other guy.
But okay.
Yeah, you vote for this person out of almost obligation. At least he's better than the other guy. You're not voting for him because he's the guy you want. You're voting to prevent the other guy from getting into power, which is of course that leads to voter apathy. The same thing has happened in South Africa. People, when they're deciding who to vote, it's anyone but that color party, anyone but that t-shirt, anyone but that person. As long as he doesn't get in, I will vote anything, so as long as that guy doesn't get in. But I don't hear any conversations anecdotally or through some of the research and focus groups we've done of people saying, I'm voting for this person because I believe they're going to fix this country. And that brings me back to this gap, this vacuum that will be filled, but I don't believe it's been filled yet, that could be filled and that should be filled and that will probably be filled by the younger generation who's going to step up rather than wait to be handed down.
We're going to take another quick break, the last one of our program, and we'll be right back after that. This is Brooke Spector. It's the Deep Dive, of course, brought to you Friday mornings. And we're speaking with Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends, who is offering all kinds of wonderfully provocative insights, not the things I thought she was going to say necessarily, but things that are even more interesting than I expected, which is why I'm delighted we have her on our program today. We'll be right back after this message.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. Our guest today, Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends. And when we left, she was talking about the next generation not waiting for the old geezers to hand over authority and power, but something like Julius Caesar, I saw it and I took it.
So that's the way you do it.
And I can't think of the exact quote from Caesar, but it's, you know, that's, I think,
came until I conquered.
that's one version of it. But what you're really saying is that it is going to be up to that this generation. Now we're thinking of people in their 30s. Am I right? 30s to 40s. Or even earlier.
I'm thinking even the younger ones. You see, that's the point. This is the point I was making before the break, that my generation, the millennial generation, people in their, say, early 30s, so say 33-ish until like the early 40s, that sort of generation has not stepped up. This was a generation that asked for permission rather than asked for forgiveness. And we're seeing that shifting to, I'd rather ask for forgiveness than ask for permission. So the sense of stepping up rather than waiting to be handed down. I think that this younger generation has seen our mistakes, has seen my generation's mistakes, has seen how we have failed to take power from elders. We've failed to take economic or political power from our parents, and we've suffered the consequences thereof. The result of us suffering those consequences is for my generation to have shifted more left in our politics, saying, you know, if we can't beat them, we're going to give up and ask for a handout, as opposed to the younger generation saying, we're not going to wait around. We're not going to wait around for our parents to die so that we can inherit their wealth, and for, you know, the old generation in academia to die off so that we can step into their roles and positions and finally get our ideas heard. Why should we wait for that? There is no time to wait. There's a sense of urgency among younger people that we cannot wait. That things like whether your particular baton that you want to carry is around the climate tipping points that we hear about all the time. So generation says, we're not going to wait for you to change your ways. We're going to force you to do it right now because that's the urgency. Or whether that is politics, we're not going to wait for your political party to, you know, sort itself out. We're going to start our own. Or we're going to vote for an outsider. We're going to vote for a wild card. we're going to create our own. So there's a sense of agents of chaos that are popping up and that are just starting to pop up now. There's also a sense that, as you mentioned earlier, this generation has started to vote more right-wing. We've seen this in Europe. We've seen it from an ethno sense, again, as I said, from a social sense here in South Africa. But we're also starting to see this generation shift rightwards in its economic policy too. There's very interesting research that's done just over the last couple of years, again, looking at the weird West, not South Africa in particular, how young people who just a year ago said that they would be investing their money in ESG or in stocks that they believe were doing good for stakeholders, not just for shareholders, have now changed their views entirely and say they are investing for themselves and to hell with the planet, which is very, very interesting. And again, very indicative of how young people are entitled to and can change their minds, and how we shouldn't, when it comes to politics, consider past performance or trends as a continuation of sort of future returns here. But what I'm saying is we should expect some unexpected surprises. We should expect new populists to materialize, and we should expect some of them to get voted for, and not in the same vein as populists have been in the past. This is a new way of looking at the world. This is a new set of chaos and agents of chaos that we're going to see emerging. Agents of chaos and new leaders that we have simply not seen in my generation. I'm not sure if any of your listeners, anyone watching this, if this is available where people can put their comments in or call in, I would challenge your listeners to list any global leaders that come out of the millennial cohort of our generation. And I'll give you one, because you're not allowed to use him because he's already been taken, and that's Mark Zuckerberg. No one likes him, but he's probably the poster child of our generation in terms of leadership. Leadership is clearly lacking in my cohort. Maybe we'll grow into it, but then we're very, very late bloomers. But there are already younger leaders who are challenging society from within and from out, without the walls of traditional power.
I would argue that there are in the American political scene some people who are your age or younger.
Younger, definitely.
Who have been elected to office and are now almost at the point of being thought of as veteran political figures, who have barely broached the 30-year mark.
For me, the younger generation, not my generation. But yes, yeah. there was that old plus. What was it, the squad in the U.S., right?
Well, two of them are older and two of them are younger. And then there is one congressman who was elected who was barely legally entitled to become elected. The bottom age is 25, and he managed to become 25 by the time he was sworn in.
I think we're going to see more of that, more young people stepping up, because the electorate is starved for choice, right? I mean, like, we starve for anything other than business as usual. So the future belongs to those who claim it.
If you were listening to Nikki Haley, the candidate, one of the two remaining candidates among the Republicans vying for the nomination for president, right at the end of the days before the New Hampshire primary, she was just starting to say, wait a minute, we shouldn't have an election between two octogenarians.
Absolutely not. We shouldn't be electing people who are going to be dead before the consequences of their actions come to light. You know, I mean, this is incredible. What is wrong with us?
Well, of course, she's 51, so she's hardly young. But compared to the people she was referring to, there's a whole generation and a half between them. And there are, if you get below the national visible threshold at state level and at the city and county level, there really is a cohort of younger politicians who have come from very diverse kinds of backgrounds, whether it's ethnically or racially or religiously, and not all of them are left liberal progressive. Some of them are pretty
they're close along to the 30s. Very interesting. Very
interesting. Practically. Now we just have a couple minutes left, and I want you to just in like 3 or 4 minutes, what does this mean? Put your futurologist hat on and your futurologist glasses on and the Ouija board in front of you. What does this mean for the election that this country is going to face in, 5 months, 4 months?
My summation of what's ahead for this election is that not much is going to change in this election. I have my eyes on the next one. I think that the next sort of 4 years are going to be a year of reckoning and soul searching and the emergence of new actual players. There are already a couple popping up from the horizons, but I'm not sure they actually have enough momentum to change the results. What we're probably going to be stuck with is a bit more of the slow kind of decline that we've become accustomed to in this country. But at the same time, we're kind of reaching a point where we're going to have some sort of a turn. So I'm definitely seeing this year as a kind of a bottom of some cycles and a top of others, as this is the turning point. But it would be still in the middle of the so-called storm, right? We shouldn't be thinking that we're going to wake up after the elections into a new world where there is something you're afraid of or something that you're excited for, depending on the sort of election results we're going to get. I foresee quite a lot more business as usual for most of us in our day-to-day lives. And that's not a great story because there's not an awful lot of people that have very nice lives in this country. We have huge inequality, huge poverty, huge issues with things like childhood stunting, really fundamental challenges that unfortunately I don't see us solving in the next while. I don't think that our coalitions are strong enough given the unequal power dynamics that we have in order to efficate real change. However, I do think that this next four-year period is the period to watch, the period where new ideas will finally be put on the table rather than just people pointing fingers at what the problems are. And that's the big opportunity gap in South African politics. It's easy to point out the problems. We all know what they are. It's easy to go and vote for someone, but vote for anyone so you don't get the guy you don't want in power. But there's very few of us that are going to the polls this year excited about the person that we're choosing. And I think that that's the gap that's going to be filled over the next 4 years, probably from our new generations, or at least who they are supporting and pointing towards and who they gravitate towards. This whole idea that we need someone to believe in again and someone to vote for, rather than just parties to vote against. And until that gap is filled, we're going to continue on the same dawdling, not particularly great downward trajectory that we've been on. That gets changed the moment someone steps up and takes the space rather than looks to the past and to the problems and starts looking to the future towards something to believe in.
I'm old enough to remember the enthusiasm in the United States when John Kennedy ran for president in 1960.
Obama. People were excited about Obama. Like they wanted to vote for him.
Yeah, that was my nick.
Right? Not everyone voted for him, but there were significant people who were excited about the new dawn. This was a new idea. This was someone to follow. When last did we see that in South African politics?
When Kennedy ran, he called his campaign, "It is time for a new generation of Americans." Now, he was 43, but he was running against an old establishment, many of whom were in their 60s already. I'm going to want to talk to you again in a couple of months, and then we're going to see just how this is starting to play out, whether your predictions are going to hold, whether we are going to look at this election as the last hurrah of the old regime or the beginning of the breakup of the Ice Age and the first election of the next regime. I think I'm going to look at it in terms of glacial movements. Does the ice flow go one way or does it disappear or does it become entirely different? Bronwyn, I want to thank you very much for sharing your time. I do appreciate it. The conversation was dramatically different than I had expected. I threw away all my questions, basically, and just let it go. And it has been a pleasure to meet you in a video link. Bronwyn Williams is from Flux. Let me get this right again here. Flux Trends. And I finally were there without hesitation. And it has been a pleasure to have you on this morning. Bronwyn Williams, Flux Trends. This is Brooke Spector, and we're The Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week in a very different field. I haven't figured out which one yet, but we try to vary this. We try to do politics, international relations, economics, arts, culture, music, literature every once in a while, just to keep us all paying attention to what's new on the horizon. Again, Bronwyn, thanks very much for joining.
Thank you so much for inviting us.